Welcome back, Red Ice members. It's great to have you along. We are having a very interesting conversation with author Anthony Peake. We're talking about, well, pretty much the theory of everything, the theory of reality, as it were. We're talking about quantum science, the weirdness of the act of observance or even awareness or consciousness in this kind of matrix that we're all involved in and experiencing. We're talking about precognition, temporal lobe epilepsy. And I want to begin now here, just ask you a little bit, Anthony, about your personal outlook on this as well in regards to what you consider reality to be. Do you feel today that this is something that you want to, if we look at it from the perspective of the Matrix again and the Matrix movies even then, in that narrative, people want to escape from that because it's actually an illusion. It's not the real reality. What's your idea of that? Do you feel that we need to move away from this and we can escape it, or are you looking forward to the day that we can kind of harness this more and actually learn to enjoy it, like living in a paradise, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. And my feeling is that this whole theory that I have, and it is, as I keep stressing, it is a theory, and that's why I want the people involved to put the contributions in one way or another, is that it seems to be, if anybody's seen the movie Groundhog Day, and in Groundhog Day, the central character, Connors, lives the same day over and over again, and he realizes he's living the same day over and over again, and he uses it to his own advantage. So what he does is he tries to bed the girl, he tries to make money and everything else. But what happens is at the end of every day, he then is reborn again, living the same day again. After many, many relivings of this, he decides that he wants to do good for doing good's sake. And he realizes he can manipulate the reality around him to do good. Now, I think in many ways, probably my theory implies that if we do live our lives over and over again in this matrix-like illusion, and at the end of every life, we go back to our birth and we live it again, but we can change it and we can do anything. Isn't it wonderful that somebody would be turning around to you guys out there and I'll say, you know that girl that you really fancied at school that you never picked up your courage to say hi to? Next time round, your daemon will tell you or warn you or give you an hint to go and speak to her. How about the time that you should have gone along and studied for that exam, but you didn't? Your daemon is there to tell you, hey, guy, this time round, study for it. How about the time when you had the opportunity to go to travel to Australia? You turned it down. This time round, you could go and do it and see what happened. The universe is your oyster. You can do whatever you want to do. And you can do it again and again and again. And that's the wonder of Cheating the Ferryman, because it's not like the Matrix. You're not trapped in this awful world that's manipulated by other beings. It's a world manipulated by you. For instance, these days, there's this massive interest in these ideas of manipulating your reality to get things you want. You know, particularly in America, there's this big theme of, you know, sort of ask and you will get. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that very much in the case of my theory, because effectively, if this is your reality and you can manipulate it, you can attract good things to you or you can attract bad things to you, depending upon your mood. I was in Switzerland a few months ago. Well, no, about 18 months ago, I was invited to talk for the Scientific and Medical Network in Switzerland in Geneva. And I did a talk at this beautiful place called Crêpe-Barand in the mountains above Geneva. And on the way back, I was being driven back by an English guy that lives out there. And I asked him why was he involved in the kind of things he was involved in? Because he was an engineer. And he said, because a very peculiar thing happened to me a few years ago. He said that I felt very, very confident and happy in myself because I felt I was in control of my life. And he said, one day I noticed something very strange. I hadn't seen a red traffic light for months. And he said, I drove to work every day and the lights were always green. And then he said, as soon as he realized this, he started to worry about it and the lights started to turn red again.
There you go.
And I said, that's you manipulating your reality. Isn't it the same? You know, don't you feel it? You know, sometimes you feel really good about things. Everything works. But if you feel the least bit down, it becomes infectious. You infect your environment around you.
Yeah.
And that's because it is your reality and you're manipulating it. The power is learning how to control it. I'm hoping my third book, I'm working with psychoanalysts, I'm working with neurologists, and we have lots and lots of ideas of how to open up the channels of communication between the daemon and the eidolon in such a way that we can maybe even progress humanity to the next level.
Mm. Very, very interesting. And in regards to that, have you any ideas or theories or even scientific knowledge about what it is that affects, let's say, our mood then in that sense? You can be very, very upbeat, you're happy, and all of a sudden, wham, something hits you and you're starting to think about, you know, problems, you worry, and it's almost like it is schizophrenic in one sense because you're switching all of a sudden, you know, to this other mode. Do you know what that comes from? What is it that is affecting us so much?
The only thing I can think of, and this is the opportunity to mention somebody I'm working with quite closely, is a guy called Carl L. Lamarck. And Carl is bipolar, severely bipolar. And bipolarity is very much those extremes we have. And I think we all have this up and down elements, you know, of being manic or depressive.
Yeah.
But I think certain people go to extremes, and those people are part of my creativity people. You know, they're in there with the TLEs and everything else, because the amount of writers, you know, Virginia Woolf, people like that who are bipolar. But I feel it's a matter of how we can control this. And I just wonder whether it's to do with the balance between eidolonic consciousness and demonic consciousness. But how that works, I don't know. And I'm leaving that to other people, purely and simply because I don't feel technically capable enough. For instance, one of the other areas we're working in, and it's very much involved with my theory, is autism and Asperger's syndrome. One of my associates and guys, that's a guy that's involved in my work, is a guy called Ed. And Ed's son is profoundly autistic. He's also got Asperger's syndrome, and he's got temporal lobe epilepsy. This lad can predict the future. This lad is seeing a different world to the world we're seeing. And we've been applying, and I know it sounds terrible, but we've been applying a lot of my theories about glutamate and the glutamate in this lad's diet, and he's getting better. He's coming out of his shell. It seems to be working. It's absolutely amazing. Mm. And it's, again, because there just seems to be these levels where the human mind... We are convinced, for instance, people that have autism, the daemon is screaming to get out, and it can't. It's trapped because the eidolon has difficulties in relating to reality. I'm in touch with the guy that was the main advisor on the movie Rain Man, and I've been in contact with him two or three times now, and he's really quite fascinated about what I'm doing as well. His name slips my mind for a second, but there are so many areas here. But what I want to do is to leave the experts to the areas like the psychiatrists. At the moment, I'm in negotiations writing a book on near-death experience with an Australian psychiatrist, consultant psychiatrist. Because, of course, near-death experience is something we haven't talked about either. You know, there's lots of gaps even now.
Yes.
And but effective... Sorry, yeah.
No, I just wanted to mention, too, because is work, rather, being done on, balancing the brain halves. Because, again, it seems to me this has been mentioned, and even actually in what's Philip K. Dick's latest movie version of this, the name of the movie escapes me now, but I'll think of it later. But where they talk pretty much about this idea as well, that there is a war going on in your brain, in your mind, these different halves of the brain.
Would this be a scanner darkly?
That's right, a scanner darkly, yeah. Obviously, yes. And what needs to be done in one sense is through, we need to balance these different sides, the polarities. And I know that there's things like hemisync, for instance, that the Monroe Institute have been working on. Have you been looking into that at all?
Yes, I've got two or three people who have been involved in the Monroe Institute, and I think there is one guy who's a member of the Monroe Institute coming along to my talk in New York. I'm particularly interested in the implications for my theory for what Monroe was doing in terms of astral travel and such like, because this then goes into the new development area, something called that Carl, my associate, calls collapsing the consciousness wave. And what we're doing with this is we're applying my theory and Carl's theory together to bring together something we're calling the Big Toe, which is the Bohmian IMAX grand theory of everything, because we believe that bringing our two theories together, we've got something incredibly powerful. Because Carl argues that there is a conscious, you know, like I was talking about the particle waves. Carl argues that there's a consciousness wave out there, and what and by being a self-conscious being, you collapse the consciousness wave, which would explain telepathy. It would explain all the things I can't explain in my theory. So it's big, powerful stuff. This, but the Monroe Institute, yeah, fascinated to talk to those guys, I think.
Do you think that we possibly also are on a developing evolutionary cycle here, so to speak, that we are, or a line that we actually are, just in the initial steps here to begin to discover this and tap into this, meaning that as the brain continues to develop and so forth, things like telepathy and tapping into a larger reality is going to be possible. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. We're finding this all the time at the moment in my group. You mentioned earlier on about synchronicity. I've adapted that word. I have a term called synchronicity. And synchronicity is when a synchronistic event becomes fortuitous in one way or the other. And we have got so, we try to keep records of these things, and they happen so often. I mean, if anybody's interested, I've put a couple of things on my forum in the last week or so that would stun the hell out of you. That the coincidences are ingrained and pointed and deep. And this is because I don't know about this. People who know me know that they like to call me Anthony Why Me Peak, because I don't quite know why it's me as opposed to somebody else that's come up with all this. And I find it rather overpowering sometimes. As you know, I was author of the month on the Graham Hancock site.
Yes.
In April. And I found it all overpowering that all these people were interested in my work. But it does. And sometimes I look back at my books now and say, my God, did you write that? And I did. But I don't know even where it came from myself. It's as if I've been driven. A lot of people, I mean, I'll give you an example of just how weird this is becoming.
Sorry to cut you off, but you're in touch with your daemon, right? Your daemon.
Yes. Yeah. That's what people say. My daemon has started to talk to me. My daemon has been guiding me to write this book, and has been for a long time. And It's something happened with myself and my wife a couple of days ago. And my wife, you know, she's very, very down to earth. And we were walking along the road, and we were walking past a drive of a house. And I heard my daemon in my voice, the voice in my head turn. I say, stop, a car's going to come through there. And I said, stop, a car's coming. We didn't even hear it. And suddenly a car shot out in front of us. Yeah. We'd have been in the middle of the road when that happened. And things like that keep happening. And I keep going, this is weird. Now, I met up with a Dr. Alan Roberts. Oh, yeah, there's the other thing as well. I've got videos on YouTube. If you just go onto YouTube and put in Anthony Peak, you'll find me. And those movies have been made by a guy called Dr. Alan Roberts. And Alan is a Zen teacher and a meditation teacher. And Alan was talking to me a couple of days ago about this. And he said, you've got to go with the flow. You're important, and you have to go with the flow on this. Stop resisting it. Go with it. Because at the moment, I'm resisting it and pushing back. Because
really?
I find, yeah. Because I find, I find all this recognition wonderful. But I'm not that type of personality. I'm not in it for personal gain. I'm definitely not in it for financial gain. I'm in it because it's so profoundly important to me. And I'm desperate to get this message across to as many people as possible because it's so important. I cannot believe just how important it is. Whether I'm running out of time, I don't know, but I have this burning need to get this message out quickly. But the reason I was going to tell the tale was that I had an email from, I also get mediums contacting me as well, which is amazing because you think that probably they would find my stuff a little bit too scientific in many ways. But I had one of Britain's top mediums who will remain anonymous because she doesn't want to be mentioned who she is, but most people in this country will know her by name. Yeah. She emailed me about 6 months ago And she said, I've just read your book and it's blown my mind. She said, because your book's explained how my spirit guides work. I've always suspected my spirit guides were in fact one being, and that being is clearly my daemon. But she said, it's how I came across your book. And she said, I have had a life full of weird things happen to me, but finding your book was the weirdest. She was on a tube train in London going to an interview at the BBC. And as the train drew into a station, there was a lady sitting opposite her. And the lady stood up and pushed her bag forward. And as she pushed her bag forward, a book fell out and fell at the feet of the medium. The medium picked the book up to hand it back to the lady. And the lady just looked at her straight in the eye and said, no, this is for you. You must read this. And got off the train. The medium was so stunned, she looked at the book and it was my first book. And she said, I started flicking through the pages and thought, my God, this is important. She said, as if my spirit guide told me this is important. She got off the train. She went up to the higher levels, phoned up the BBC and said, I'm not coming in for the interview. I'll come in tomorrow. There's something more important I have to do. She went back to her hotel room and she read that book and she finished it at 4 o'clock the next morning. And she said, it's changed my life. And things like that, I keep getting from around the world. People tell me stories about how they encountered my book. It's weird. Very, very weird. Other people have said it's something to do with 2012.
Okay.
And I have no idea about that. Another gentleman, an Indian gentleman, who is one of the world's top pediatricians. You know, he's a professor of pediatrics. Spends a lot of time traveling the world with Kofi Annan, and he met me a few months ago, and he was very keen to know more about me. He wanted to know where I'd been born, what date of birth, my location of birth and everything. And he said, I'll come back to you when I have some time. And he had me hold certain things and asked me what sensations I was getting. I still don't know what he was up to or why, because he didn't come back to me, but it's weird. It's weird.
Do you think that this weirdness, as you describe, actually is also a phenomenon that will increase if you indeed recognize the weirdness and that it's real and that it's affecting your life, meaning that it's kind of a feedback loop, I guess, in one sense, that the more you open up to it, the more you will start to see it happen. Do you think that's the case?
Oh, totally. You know, it does seem to be that the messages are getting louder and louder and louder day on day. It's getting more and more. And as Alan said to me a couple of days ago, he said it will build up. He said, you're manipulating your reality around you. And he said, you need to listen to what your reality is trying to tell you, because, you know, the coincidences are now piling up. You know, that even today when I was talking to I had a meeting today with J.B. Priestley's son, Tom Priestley, because I'm doing a platform event at the National Theatre in London on the 24th of July. I've been invited down there to talk on the time theories of a guy called J.W. Dunn, which is again another area I can spin off into if you need to.
And just briefly, both Dunn and Priestley, they have written similar books, isn't that right? It's still in novel form, isn't it?
Yeah, what J.B. Priestley was profoundly affected by a book written in the 1930s by a guy called J.W. Dunn called An Experiment with Time. And in An Experiment with Time, Dunn was fascinated by precognitive dreams. And he found that he had had one or two phenomenally odd precognitive dreams. And in these dreams, he subsequently discovered that the precognitive dream was not about the event, but it was about him reading about the event. In other words, he had had a precognition about him reading a newspaper article, for example. He was so fascinated by this that he wrote this book called Man and Time, called An Experiment with Time. He came up with a fascinating theory about how time may work. And in the idea that we travel through time as an observer, but time is static, that all time exists out there as a permanent present. Everything that can happen and has happened exists out there as a permanent, in now. It is human consciousness that travels through it and views it as it travels along, like a train travels along a rail track.
Yes.
The rail track and the stations are still there when you've gone through them. It's just that your view through the window has changed, which was quite fascinating. But J.B. Priestley, the playwright, was so fascinated by the theories of J.W. Dunn that he wrote a series of plays called his Time Plays. And the first one was called I Have Been Here Before, and I'll come back to that play in a second. Mm-hmm. But the second one was called Time and the Conways. And in Time and the Conways, it is in three acts, but the second act has the most amazing time slip, where the character, the central character, finds herself 30 years in the future. And then the final act is her going back into the past again, because she's 30 years in the future and she sees the implications of the things that people do. And again, that was Priestley trying to apply the theories of J.W. Dunn. And this is what I'll be lecturing or talking about at the National Theatre. And I'll be on stage with Professor Jeff Forshaw, who is one of Britain's youngest particle physicists. Brilliant, brilliant guy. Who, by the way, admitted to me last time I met him, and get this one, and this is one of the world's top particle physicists. He said to me, we know that every electron in the universe knows the location of every other electron.
Mm-hmm.
This is science. You know, this is not some guy writing New Age. This is a professor of particle physics at Manchester where they discovered so many things at the turn of the last century.
Yes.
But going back to the other play that J.B. Priestley did, which was called I Have Been Here Before, and that's based upon the theories of the eternal recurrence of a Russian philosopher called Peter Ouspensky. And Ouspensky's theories were probably the most influential on my own theories. And he posits, rather like I do, that at the time of your death, you go back to the time of your life and you live your life over and over and over again. And it's a concept. It's called the eternal recurrence. And it's been known since 2000 years. People have known about this idea.
This is the Ouspensky who was working together with Gurdjieff for a while, wasn't it?
With Gurdjieff, yes.
All right.
Yeah, exactly. I'm very interested in Ouspensky and Gurdjieff for differing reasons. But the fourth way, which is very much the ideas of Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, is very much in keeping with my theories, totally. As is theosophy. You know, there are so many esoteric belief systems. For instance, my first book is suggested reading for the world's largest esoteric training group called the Servants of the Light.
Hmm.
And again, right. If you check out and you go onto the website of the Servants of the Light, you will find that the top lady in there, a lady called Dolores Ashcroft Nowicki, actually said that Anthony Peake's book is required. It's not required reading, but it is of profound importance to our belief system because Anthony is... He's putting forward scientific theories that we've known as occultists for the last 300 or 400 years.
Mm, that's interesting.
You know, it's even that freaking, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So,
in fact,
go ahead.
I was just going to say I've been invited. I've actually given lectures to the Servants of the Light twice, and Dolores, you know, is really just fascinated by my stuff.
Are they based out of the U.S. or England or?
They're based out of England. Dolores lives in the Channel Islands, but she spends an awful lot of time in America. Fascinatingly interesting. And again, they took on board my Damon Adelon dyad. They said, no, absolutely. This is exactly what we have known for years. And most esoteric traditions have this whole concept. You know, I find it amazing. Even Scientology has a concept called the operating thetan.
Mm-hmm.
It's my Damon. You know, it spins out. There are the books of the Book of Arantia, which is another esoteric group. They have a concept which is absolutely identical, the thought adjuster, absolutely identical to my Damon. But none of these guys are doing science. They're doing the esoteric belief systems. It's the same thing. Hmm. It's just I'm proving the science.
And that's always interesting in that sense, because that means that the fields in that sense are beginning to overlap and... This has been, you know, mentioned as well from I guess prophetic sources that this is also something that in one way needs to take place, if you know what I mean, in regards to the importance and the development even of human consciousness, that we need to not only have an esoteric theory about it or an idea about it, but we also need to understand it from a scientific point of view, because that will help. I mean, not everyone is laid towards the esoteric type of thinking, if you know what I mean. And some people actually need the science because they're just hardwired in that way, it feels like, that they need to have the science put in front of the eyes in order to understand it in another way, if you know what I mean.
I do, but that's the whole frustration of it all, that if you guide people to the latest areas of particle physics, it's like black magic. You have particles that disappear and reappear. You have quantum leaping. You have action at a distance, something called the EPR paradox, whereby there are two objects both traveling in different directions at vast speeds and they instantaneously communicate with each other. You've got parts that you don't even need anything mystical. There's enough mystical things going on in particle physics. And any particle physicist that turns around and says he understands what's going on is lying. They don't know. They haven't got a clue. We are in exactly the same position scientifically as we were in 1901, when effectively the Einsteinian revolution came along and the quantum revolution came along. There are too many things that we cannot explain. We can't explain dark matter. We can't explain dark energy. Most of the universe is missing. It doesn't balance. But the scientists don't want to talk about these things because they don't have the answers. But to me, it's the concept of the black swan, which is the idea that if something doesn't fit in, you have to investigate it.
That's right.
To ignore it is silly and it is stupid.
Yeah.
I was interested you were talking about predictions and predicting things. It's been pointed out to me that Philip K. Dick predicted me.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is really, really odd. And I even find it still strange. Philip K. Dick wrote a novel in 1966, I think it was, called Counter Clock World. And in Counter Clock World, there is a character who comes up with this revolutionary new theory about what happens to human consciousness at the point of death. Philip K. Dick called this person Anarch Peak.
Okay, there you go. Mm-hmm.
Isn't that weird?
How about that, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Now,
did you have this pointed out to you, or have you read the book before that?
No, it was pointed out to me in a lecture. I was doing a lecture in Bolton over here in the UK. And again, there's a whole story of a whole series of the most bizarre synchronicities that surrounded this particular night. And it's called the Cordoba Effect, by an associate of mine called Mick. And I'm hoping that Mick will be putting some more... you'll find all this on my blog site, by the way. Mick has put a whole thing about the Cordoba Effect. And Mick explains that night from his point of view. But effectively, I'd not heard of this story at all. And I knew of the story, but I hadn't read it. And it was them that turned around to me and said, you know, he's predicted you. Now, I don't believe that. I just think it's an interesting coincidence. But it is a significant coincidence, which probably has some deeper meaning that is somewhat beyond me. But it is odd, I have to say.
Oh, very odd. What do you think is the deal, so to speak, with Philip K. Dick? I mean, what is he was able to tap into this for some reason. People have talked about his Valis book, for instance.
There's other
things going on there.
I turn around to people and I say, read my book, then read Valis. Valis is a fictionalized... because, of course, it's not fiction, because it's based upon the events that took place in March of 1974 to Philip K. Dick, which he called his exegesis. And you read his book, and then you read mine, then read his. It's as if he'd read my theory and then applied it. He also wrote another story called Ubik. And Ubik has a group of individuals who are living in a state called half-life, which is in the final few seconds of their life, and they're reliving and being able to go back and relive their lives. It's incredible. Philip K. Dick could have written my book for me. And that's why I'm delighted now to be in contact with Tessa Dick, who was Philip K. Dick's fifth wife. And Tessa was with Phil through all of his theophany and all the weird and wonderful things that happened to him in those few years. And Tessa is now a member of my forum and has already made contributions. And I'm very, very excited about that, because Tessa was there. And
would you put William Blake, we talked about him before, would you put him in the same category. I mean, these are primarily, from that point of view, artists. They're not scientists per se, but they're still tapping into something. And do you think how should I put this? Do you think that this knowledge about this stuff is want to get out, to be known in that sense, or is this just random floating around everywhere and people will pick up on these ideas and put them out there in whatever way or, you know, fashion? Some people call this tapping into the muse, or I would guess you'd say the daemon then, of course, but
yes.
What's your take on it?
We have discussed this long and hard on the forum and on the blog site as to whether is this because the daemons of each individual now feel it is time to be known. For instance, if we have had this daemonic element to ourselves ever since we evolved, or ever since, if you take the theories of Julian James, I know if you've come across James's work on the bicameral mind.
Absolutely, very interesting.
All right. Yes. Okay, you might be interested as an aside here. Julian James, when he wrote the book back in 1976, took the manuscript to another of his lecturers at Princeton, a guy called Professor David Loy. And David was the person who first read the manuscript of the bicameral mind and turned round to Julian and said, you really need to get this published. And David helped him get it published. Mm. I had an email from David Loy about 3 or 4 months ago, having read The Daemon. And he said, your book is as potentially explosive and as potentially powerful as Julian James' bicameral mind. And in fact, he had a copy of my book sent to Professor Irvin Laszlo in Italy, because he said this book is of profound importance. Mm. So, you know, there are lots of people now sort of really twigging into this theory. But going back, it's the idea of whether the daemons want to be known or not. And I really don't know, but I suspect that the very fact that things are happening the way they are, that yes, they are. And I just wonder, it's because whether they feel that society, for whatever reason, we're reaching a crisis. And maybe collectively, every single daemon on the planet is screaming out now and saying, if we don't do something soon, Armageddon is going to happen again. And we have to do something. Maybe that's what 2012 is all about. And because all the daemons, your daemon, my daemon, everybody else's daemon, if there is a conflagration around 2012, we're all going to die, which means that all those daemons know that's going to happen. And there's this desperate, we have to get this message out now to stop this happening. I don't know. It's the first time I've ever said that on a radio program, but it's a possibility.
Do you think that we are, I mean, in that sense, are we the daemons, or are we just a tool for them? What would you say is their interest in regards to saving this environment? Is that because, as you said, we are intricately connected here, meaning that if we go, they go?
Yeah, the daemon is you. You are your daemon.
Right.
The daemon is your, for want of a better term, the Gnostics, and again, coming into Gnosticism now. Mm-hmm. But Gnostics, the schismatic Christian sect of Gnostics in the 2nd and 3rd century AD, believed that the universe we live in has been created by a false god, which they call the Demiurge. It was their way of explaining evil, because they worked under the logic that if there is a good God, how can evil be tolerated? Right. And they decided that what had happened was that another God had taken over and built this universe, but he got it wrong. And there is a universe behind this universe called the Pleroma. And within the Pleroma is the real God and the real world. And we live in this illusion. And part of us, the spark, knows that, and that, I would argue, is the daemon, and that's what the Gnostics believed was the daemon. And this is what William Blake believed. It nicely comes back to William Blake, because William Blake was a Gnostic, and Blake believed the same kind of idea. And Philip K. Dick was a Gnostic. You read all of Philip K. Dick's novels. He was preoccupied with the idea of illusion, that reality is an illusion. I mean, particularly, you read some of his later novels. I mean, Valis, for instance, you know, the whole thing is we're still living in the Roman Empire, mm-hmm. as far as Dick was concerned. And that he was convinced of that. He wrote it as a fiction. Mm-hmm. The character Horse Lover Fat in Valis. Have you noticed anything about the name of the character?
Oh, I remember this. What was it? It was something with the translation of horse lover fat that becomes Philip K. Dick or something like that, right?
Yeah, horse lover is Phil in Greek is Phil. Phil Hippus is to love horses, and Dick is German for fat.
There you go.
So horse lover fat is Philip K. Dick.
Yes.
But also in the novel is a character called Philip K. Dick, who's a science fiction novelist. That was Dick. That was Dick. And horse lover fat is his daemon. So he's writing about the Damon Eidolon diet again.
Yes.
But effectively, coming back to Gnosticism, so they believe that there is a part of you that is part of the Pleroma, part of the universe behind the universe. And indeed, I argue in my first book that this is the secret of the Cathars. I also argue that this is probably what the real Holy Grail is. Forget the Holy Grail being the bloodline of Christ. Forget the Holy Grail being the idea of the chalice that held the blood of Christ. I argue that the Cathars, who were the people who carried this through, were a Gnostic religious group. And I think the Holy Grail is this duality thing that I deal with now. And I believe that's the secret. And that's why the Cathars died for it. Because if you look into what happened to the Cathars, they believe the same things I'm suggesting.
Now, to just for a little while turn this towards the more darker aspect to this. This is also knowledge, then. If you have this knowledge, you can use this in order to actually manipulate reality for those who are not aware of it, right? Or for those who don't know how this stuff works. Do you think that has been done, is being done, could be done in the future?
That's a possibility, but then we have the interesting aside, though, that if you and I are living in our own Everett universes, this is your universe. In other words, we're communicating effectively in different universes. So therefore, anything that happens within your universe is part of your world, if that makes any sense.
Yes,
so therefore,
yes.
How you manipulate your world is up to you. It's still populated by real people because I never want to fall into the trap which is called solipsism, which is the idea that other people are illusions. They're not. They're real. It's just we're all overlapping like this eternal golden braid of life. But effectively, there could be people that might be manipulating in certain ways. And I wonder, for instance, with DMT, with bad trips on DMT, bad trips with ketamine, which is another substance that I discuss in my books. Could this be that, because I don't even argue that necessarily daemons are good. There could be bad daemons, what I call a cacodemon. You know, effectively Hitler's daemon ensured he survived, didn't it? You know, with the Stauffenberg bomb plot, Hitler's daemon or somebody allowed Hitler to kick the bomb behind the pillar, and he survived. So clearly, within that universe, that was bad news for an awful lot of people. Of course, there could be the counter-argument to say that that only happened in our version of history. Because, you know, in Philip K. Dick's book, The Man in the High Castle, he suggests an alternate history where America was defeated by Japan during the war. And this guy's living in this alternate history. But this, again, is my theory. You know, there are alternate histories, and we can exist within alternate histories as well.
And can we interact or change history, depending on where we decide to be at what time, if we talk about this idea that we kind of jumping back and forth in the timelines or whatever, meaning that we can possibly experience or interact or change history, which would obviously change the present, right?
Well, that's the interesting thing with the argument of if you go back in time, it's the grandfather paradox, isn't it? The idea, if I go back in time and I kill my grandfather, I will not exist. Therefore, I can't go back in time to kill my grandfather. This is why people posit the idea of the Everett Many Worlds interpretation. Because, of course, you go back and you kill your grandfather and you make the universe split into a different version of itself. But the version that you existed in still exists. So therefore, you still exist.
Right.
Because, funnily enough, the whole argument of Everett's Many Worlds has an interesting side, is that it's something called the cosmological anthropic principle. And this is something that has fascinated me for a long time, is that if there's only ever been one universe, the universe was hardwired for the evolution of intelligent life as we know it from the first few moments of the Big Bang. Now, people will argue and say, oh, that's just the idea that you're looking back. And of course, if you didn't exist, you wouldn't be looking back. But you look back to the first few moments of the Big Bang, so many things happened that had to happen so that life evolved. Any form of life. So it means that the universe got everything right first time. Mm. Unless there are thousands and trillions of universes, in which case we're just the one that got it right, which is an interesting aside. But it means, again, here's again evidence of the idea that there probably are multiverses.
Or what about the idea that there is only one, but it's constantly readjusting and changing itself on a... I know that Jim Elwood, for instance, talk about this thing about the clock cycle, if you will, of the universe, or that there's a specific speed at which, you know, for something to move one increment or one distance, or I don't know how to term that properly, but the idea is that everything is constantly changing around in order to just fit the periphery of the person who's observing it, or the awareness of that person. Mm-hmm. Could that be the case?
Yes, that could be as well. I mean, there is the idea. I mean, I think, again, that's almost the idea of collapsing the wave function. You know, you an act of observation, you collapse it, and therefore you bring it into existence. You look away, it no longer exists there anymore, and you're changing it all the time by your act of observation. I think there is what we need is a lot of creative thinking here, and of putting together people like Jim and myself and Rick Straussman, and there's lots of other guys around the world, of getting together and saying, hey guys, you know, what have we actually got here? What are we really coming out with here? And then and I'm sure there'll be a flash of inspiration, and we'll go, crumbs, that's it. We couldn't see it, but it's there. And that's why I'm so excited about, I mean, I have emailed Jim, and Jim and I have swapped emails, and it's again the idea of us all working together to make it happen, or do something, but I'm not sure what we're supposed to do yet. I'm waiting for the instructions from my daemon, I think.
Well, in one way, again, if we might be boring to go back to the Matrix analogy again, then.
Oh, not at all. Love the Matrix.
But in that sense, what they're doing there is that they're overcoming the boundaries of that the constructed universe or world that they're living in because of their Neo's Thomas Anderson's belief of it, or he's overcoming the idea that okay, this is a confined space that we're in, and it has certain rules, but actually you can overcome these rules, you can actually break free of them, and the only thing it takes is his belief that he can manage to do that, and ideas, for me at least, are like that. If you think it's possible, just look at human history, for instance. If everything that we've done and accomplished, if you will, so far, has been done because of a thought or an idea about a car, or, you know, if we talk about technological advancement or scientific progress, whatever you want to term that. But it starts with an idea, and that's why the idea is the most important thing. And then afterwards, we begin to unravel and put that into, we manifest it, basically, if you know what I mean.
I think that's a very interesting point, in that another member of my blog site and my forum is a guy called Jake Horsley. And Jake wrote a wonderful book called The Matrix Being the One, which is unfortunately out of print, but I think you might be able to get copies of it. And Jake very much takes that viewpoint. I mean, Jake is very much part of my group in terms of the philosophy and ideas. And again, it's the message within The Matrix. The Matrix is an incredibly powerful movie. I have heard that, I know that the Wachowski brothers were the guys behind it, but I know that they very much acknowledged that Philip K. Dick was the main influence behind a lot of their writings. But the symbolism, it's sheer Gnosticism. You know, the idea of the oracle, the concept of the oracle. I think the third movie lost it a little bit. But I have to say the first one was a stupendous piece of cinema. I think the other movie that has profound messages to it as well, because I love movies, I'll talk about movies for hours if you want, but the movie I think that really is very, very powerful in terms of the message of my book is Vanilla Sky.
Yeah, indeed.
You know, and another one, I think Jacob's Ladder. And Butterfly Effect.
Absolutely. I think Jake might be listening to this program, by the way, so we can say hi, Jim, as well.
All right.
But anyway, hi, Jake. Okay. If we go back to the idea of precognition again, I know that you talked briefly, and maybe we can spend just a few minutes here before we begin to round up on this idea about how things seem to come to us in that sense from the future, upcoming events, big changing events, historical events like 9/11, things like this. You talked about this in one of your video presentations, that album cover by Coop, for instance, or whatever, where you have the Twin Towers, you know, the image right there of when the Twin Towers explode or hit by a plane or whatever really actually happened there. And what do you think that this is? Is this some kind of resonance from the future upcoming event that is so big and profound in terms of how it influences the collective mind, so we actually can feel the impact of it ahead of time, or some people can feel the impact of it ahead of time? Or what do you think is going on there?
Well, I think I'd go back to my Damon Adelon idea, in that if you have part of you that's lived this life before, that part of you will remember the build-up to 9/11, for instance. So therefore, the interesting thing is, I argue that the Damon sometimes, particularly in the first life rerun, the Damon isn't quite sure. It remembers things, but it's not quite sure. You know, rather like you've seen a movie before, and you think, because it happens to us, so you watch a movie and you go, I've seen this movie before. I think I know what's going to happen next. And I think in the second life rerun, I think that's what the Damon does. It vaguely remembers things and suddenly starts going to its Eidolon, hey, I think something's going to happen here, but it doesn't know how to communicate it. So I think that's why something like 9/11 resonates, because your Damon remembers it, and more Damons remember it, because it was a big event. Mm. What surprises me is that more people didn't. I know that a lot of people didn't turn up on the day. And this is interesting, because a guy called Eugene Ostie did similar research in the past over in terms of accidents, I think it was, and train crashes. And he found that the number of people that traveled on trains that subsequently crashed were statistically 50% or whatever the number of people that would normally be on that train. Mm. It's as if people subliminally avoid accidents. In my first book, I have a whole section of people on the Titanic. The Titanic was amazing. The amount of people that for one reason or another didn't go, decided, voices told them, that they just had hunches, feelings. And it's because the Damon is screaming away going, you don't do it again. For God's sake, you did it last time and you got killed. Hmm. But the Damon doesn't worry about it, because it thinks, well, it doesn't matter. We'll be round again next time. And next time I'll try a different approach and a different warning. I mean, it could just be that sometimes that, you know, the Damon decides, no, it's not worked out this time round. I'll let the person follow the route because I missed out on the opportunity to change things. My favorite story of how the Damon, I think how my Damon changed my life and saved my life, was that, have we got time for this?
Yeah, sure, right. Absolutely. Go ahead. We can round things up on this note, yes.
Okay. And it does round it up quite nicely. As you know, my theory suggests that part of you has lived your life before and you're living in a three-dimensional illusion which is created by your mind. But that illusion is still quite real and you can die within that illusion. And you live your life again and you get to the point close to where you died last time. And this part of you will remember and will try and warn you to avoid you not dying. Okay? That's mm-hmm. the theory. Mm-hmm. Back in 1988, I think it was, I picked up a magazine called Q, which is an English rock magazine, because rock music's my other great love. And they used to give free CDs on the front, showing and giving you free tracks. And one of the tracks on this CD, when I played it, there was one track which resonated so strongly. And it was a track called Round of Blues by the American folk singer called Sean Colvin. And this song, when I listened to it, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what this song meant to me. So I then turned round to my then common law wife and I said, I want this song played at my funeral. And she said, why? And I said, I don't know. Please, I want it played. And she said, but it's a happy, upbeat song. And I said, yes, but I want it played at my funeral. And I actually demanded it was put in my will. Anyway, many years later, unfortunately, that relationship failed for different reasons. And I ended up with my present wife. And one of the things when Penny and I got together was I said right at the very start, I played her that song and I said, I want this song played at my funeral. And Penny's reaction was exactly the same as Jenny's. It was, why? And I said, I don't know. just please. And again, we updated my will to reflect this. Anyway, 2005, I think it was, November. It's a really bad weather day, and I'm driving over the M62 motorway, which runs across probably one of the highest parts of Britain, and the weather conditions up there can be really horrible. Now, I have what's called an Arcos MP3 player. These are super MP3 players. And as I say, I have a huge record collection, and I've digitized all my record collection. I have about 14,000 separate MP3s. And when I'm driving in my job, I have this on random play all the time, and I'd had it on for months, random play. So you got a 1 in 14,000 chance of a track coming up. I'm driving over the motorway, and I come to a place near Milne Row, which people who know the motorway will know. And as I'm driving along there, suddenly, out of the blue, on random play, Round of Blues comes on. I'd had that MP3 player for about 4 years. I'd never played it. Something in my head said, this is significant. This means something. I felt myself swerve the car into the slow lane. As I did so, the lorry in front of me had a load of crash barriers on it. The crash barriers came crashing off the back of the lorry. Had I been behind that, those crash barriers would have killed me. I now know why that song was significant. It was because it was the last song I heard in my last life. And that's why I associated it with my funeral. That's a really true story.
Really? That's really, yeah. Really interesting. How about that? So is this in that regard, you mentioned this a little bit before there, but is it in any terms kind of freaking you out, or are you beginning to kind of acclimatize to your reality of what is happening in the world, and how everything for you is playing out?
I'm starting to, particularly because there's a nice code to that story, in that I don't know if you've read any books by Jenny Randles.
No, I have not.
She's a very popular English UFO writer, but she's also about 3 or 4 years ago wrote a book on time storms, which is well worth reading. It's very good. Mm-hmm. And I picked this up at random from Liverpool Central Library the day before yesterday, and I started reading it, and there's one section that's not on time storms, and it's just on coincidences and synchronicity. And Jenny describes a story about a friend of hers who was driving along the M62 motorway when something occurred which made her turn into the slow lane as the lorry in front of her shed its load.
Oh, no.
Seriously. Oh, I've emailed. I'm going to put that on my forum. That is just freaky. Now, you know, it makes me think, my God, that is wheels within wheels. So yeah. It happened to somebody else within 10 miles of the same incident on the same motorway.
How about that?
Yep,
so it's makes... so it's yeah, okay, what can you say? It's and what I guess also then in one sense what you're trying to do also with your forum and so forth in regards to working with other people is to build I'd reckon some kind of archive of this, or kind of to begin to correlate events so that you can see if there's other things going on like this, because again, we can possibly build a picture here of what's going on, and this is going to further strengthen the theory, I guess, right?
Exactly. Well, that's what we're doing. We're using the forum. I'm collecting, as I say to people in my books, if you read my book and you've had experiences that are similar, please let me know, because we want to build up an archive. Now, the wonderful thing today was when I met Tom Priestley, I forgot to mention that Tom Priestley's father, J.B. Priestley, in the 1930s, had a whole series of radio programs. And he was interested in dream precognitions and precognitions coming true. And he wrote a lot of these up in a book called Man and Time. But Tom Priestley today was telling me, he said, do you know that he received literally thousands of letters from people with their precognitions? And he said he published about 20 in the book. And he turned around and he said, do you know that I gave that archive to the Society of Psychical Research in London, and he said they've still got that archive, so if you were interested in having a look at that and using it, I can always ask them. So I have potentially 20,000 precognitions that nobody's ever published before that I can use as well, and that was, again, fantastic.
That's really
I want Yeah, I want people's information. I want this to be a movement, not a movement, it's wrong. And the last thing I ever want this to be is a cult, because it isn't. What it is a group of people getting together saying, look, we need to understand this.
Yeah.
And I want help, I want assistance, I want people to put their ideas and thoughts. We're now a community. Cheating the ferryman no longer belongs to Anthony Peak. It belongs to everybody, and we're all part of it, and we're all involved in it. So please join in. Put your comments on if you want to criticize. Great. I want criticism. I want people to say your science doesn't work, because if it doesn't, we'll look at it.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it's profoundly important. That's exactly why I set up everything.
Very, very good. It's been really, really interesting having you here, Anthony, and I hope that we can do it again soon and talk about some of the things that we didn't have time for this time around. There's just so much more, and I reckon that this will only develop further. You're writing the third book now, but for anyone interested in getting copies of your work, getting further into your research, please mention your titles again and your website URL so people can go over there and check it out.
Okay. My website is anthonypeake.com. That's Anthony with an H and Peake, P-E-A-K-E.com, anthonypeake.com. And on there is my forum, which effectively is a clickable section. But if you want to go directly to the forum, it's just anthonypeake.com/forum. On the forum, there is a link to my blog site as well, which has a lot of historical material. There's a lot on there already. I would suggest anybody, you could probably spend at least a week going through the archive material. There is so much on there. In terms of my books, my first book is called Is There Life After Death? The Extraordinary Science of What Happens When You Die. And the second book is called The Daemon, A Guide to Your Extraordinary Secret Self. Both these books are available on Amazon. The first book has been translated into various foreign languages anyway. It's also available in the States and everywhere else. The second book is available in Europe. And also I'm quite happy to send copies of the book from myself, which I will sign copies and also probably send one or two other bits and pieces that you can't get directly from any other sources. And all you need to do on there is go on to my website and you can order the books directly there on PayPal. That also helps me as well, so which all helps in keeping it all going. So please get in contact. I want your emails. I want your involvement. I want your criticism if need be. Do you think I'm a loon ball? If I am, great. You know, that's what it's all about. But we're building something deep and important.
Absolutely. And again, Anthony, you mentioned your upcoming appearances in the US and the UK for people.
Yeah, I will do. I'll be down at the National Theatre in London, in the Littleton Theatre, and I'll be on stage with Professor Jeff Forshaw, Professor of Particle Physics at Manchester University, and we'll be doing a platform event, and I'll be discussing the time theories of J.W. Dunn. That will be on the 24th of July. I'm then travelling over to the States. And on the 3rd of August, I will be giving a talk at the Roosevelt Hotel on Fifth Avenue in New York. This is a free event, and there's also nibbles afterwards if you want to come along and say hi, because it'd be really great if you could get along. And then the next day, I'll be doing a talk at Fairleigh Dickinson University up in New Jersey, near Hackensack, I think it is. Again, this is a free event, and again, we're hoping that the weather will be nice and we will be out on the lawns and have a snack on there as well. Now, what is particularly interesting about that event at Fairleigh Dickinson is that I'll be lecturing in the hall that they use the backdrop for the movie It's a Wonderful Life, I nearly said
The Beautiful Mind.
Yeah. And because the gentleman in question was profoundly schizophrenic, and if you've seen the movie, you will understand why that is particularly apposite, I think.
Very interesting. Well, okay, thank you very much, Anthony, for coming on our program. Keep up the good and, of course, interesting work, and we hope to have you back with us soon again on the program to talk more.
Henrik, I would love it. I've enjoyed it totally. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity.
We hope you enjoyed our program with Anthony Peake. Thank you very much for listening. We will be back on Thursday with much more radio, all for your consideration. My thanks to Fredrik behind the controls. Take good care, and don't forget to have some fun, and we will talk more soon. Bye-bye.